Welcome to It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics and practice presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, or NSHEN. I'm Marika Warren, network ethicist for NSHEN, and I'll be your host for this discussion. As always, we welcome suggestions for future topics and guests, but today I'm joined by Dr. Christy Simpson, who is the Ethics Collaborations Coordinator in the Dalhousie Department of Bioethics and whose research work has focused on rural health ethics. Our discussion today is going to look at how living in rural locations can affect access to care. So maybe to start us off, Christy, you can briefly give us an example of some of the typical ways that we tend to think about access to care in rural communities and why that's a matter for ethical concern.
Sure. Thanks, Marika, for inviting me here today to talk about this. In terms of access to care in rural communities, one of the ways that I think we miss the mark, if you will, is that we tend to think about access in terms of who can get to the care or who gets to the door, who's ranked, who can get in, who can see what services, what specialists. We tend to think less about what does it take to get there, about the questions of journeys, about the amount of travel it might take to show up for appointments, especially with specialists, which are often in urban settings. And so that starts to raise questions about where do we distribute healthcare services across urban to rural locations? What does it mean in terms of various rural communities that are heterogeneous? When they're mixed, when they have different strengths and weaknesses, what does that mean in terms of what you seek in terms of healthcare, but also what are you able to access, legitimately access in terms of healthcare? And I think finally, one of the things that often comes up when we're doing more of a policy analysis about rural healthcare and access to healthcare in rural locations is a question of, is the rural focus even thought of? Or is policy one size fits all? So rural then becomes more of an afterthought about what do we owe in terms of providing access to care for those in rural locations.
All right. So I think one thing I just wanted to pick up on in that description that I think was implicit, but maybe you could bring out a bit more, is that sort of idea of what the default is for healthcare. So you said, you know, you go to see a specialist, and of course that's in the urban setting. And so maybe talking a bit about, you know, some of the various ways that that sort of urban setting as the default for healthcare sort of plays out in the way that we structure the healthcare system.
Sure. Yes. And you're absolutely right that the urban is often the default or sort of assumed as sort of the norm. This is how we think about healthcare. And of course, it does make sense to think about how do we maximize the healthcare resources we have. Often we tend to think maximizing them in terms of having our specialists together, having specialized high-level care all in one location. And while that makes a lot of sense, the next question about well, how does that serve the population from urban to suburban to rural doesn't always get asked in that part of it. And so that part of if it is the default is back to the urban, it does mean then from a rural perspective, you're going, hey, wait a minute, what about me? What about my access to care? What about my access to specialists? Do I always have to travel into sort of an urban location to receive that type of care?
All right. So thinking about again, you know, starting with that position in a rural context, I'm wondering if that can help us think differently about what's needed for care or what matters in terms of health outcomes. Is it that access to specialists that really makes a difference? Or, you know, when we look at rural contexts, is there something else that comes out?
I think there's a variety of factors. And part of what I love about doing this work is it's not all one or the other. It's kind of taking a textured approach to really looking at it from an urban lens, which we often start with, and then flipping it to say, well, does that look the same starting from a rural perspective? And if we start from a rural perspective, I think there's a number of different things that become relevant. So one is often people in rural communities sometimes very much identify as being part of a community. And so look to their neighbors, look to their acquaintances, look to those that are around them for support. And in small communities, often that includes their local hospital or access to a closer hospital, and that sense of familiarity or relationship that comes with working with healthcare providers or their physician or their nurse practitioner, that building of relationship becomes important as well, which is not something that is as obvious sometimes when we start from the urban perspective. So if we look at how healthy our populations are, from a rural perspective, health tends to be not as good, right? Or tends to be more poor in rural communities. And so there's often statistics about how worse off, if you will, quote unquote, people are in rural communities. But I think from a statistics perspective, one, I want to say yes to that. But the other side of it is also some persons in rural communities are also engaged in really risky professions or occupations. So farming, mining, the oil and gas industry, fishing, they are naturally and inherently come with high risk as well. So how do we factor in thinking about persons who are taking on high risk to provide us with food and what we owe them in terms of healthcare as well? And so that piece can start to come in to think differently around, well, what do we owe persons in rural communities in terms of healthcare when they're the ones that are helping sustain our communities wherever we live?
Excellent. I think there's an interesting question that you could say around obligations to each other and a recognition of reciprocity as well in terms of how we understand what we're offering to each other and what we owe each other. And again, thinking about how we structure things in light of that. And I'm wondering about when we think about access to care, sort of what that looks like in a sort of really physical sense in some rural communities, sort of what for that community does it feel like or does it look like to have sort of good access to care? Is it that, you know, you don't have to travel? Is it that you have an emergency department that's available to you, you know, in a 15-minute drive from your home? Sort of what are some of the ways that that really plays out in concrete fashion?
Yeah, I think it includes all the examples that you just provided, but it also depends fundamentally on the community that you're in. And I think the more rural you become, those questions of access start to take on a different form. So for some communities that are historically used to having a local rural hospital, the questions of emergency department closures or the closure of the hospital itself becomes very, very significant because often communities are oriented around seeing a healthcare facility as a marker of we're still here, we still exist, we're thriving, if you will, as a community. And if that community or if that hospital is closed or that emergency department closes, then there's that sense of, oh, like we're not important anymore, we're not relevant. And so there can be that larger conversation within communities about the meaning and significance of having access to healthcare kind of in your home community. But for a lot of other rural communities, it may be we have access to primary care or some form of primary care, whether that's a collaborative care center, nurse practitioner, physician. So changing up the models and offering different types of models of care, I think, is something that a number of rural communities have said, we're open to that. We want to have access to care, but we're open to different formats and the ways that it can come together. And then it does raise that question of, well, then how far should you travel? And I put the should word in there specifically to say, well, what is an reasonable expectation about how far you might need to travel to access some forms of care when we know sometimes it's going down the street in an urban setting to maybe spending 45 minutes in traffic in an urban setting? And then when you move rurally, it may mean very, very long drives, but it may also mean helicopter flights or air travel, and it could be hours and hours away from home as well. And in that sense, then, that for from a rural perspective, access to care becomes something that's more about how far will I be away? Who gets to come with me? Will people be able to visit me? Having those community ties is often something that people say they miss when they're in an urban location or have been had to travel to access care or more specialized care. And so that balance then of where specialized services are located or how close they are to different people, I think, or different communities, becomes really relevant.
And I like that point you flagged, too, around what of the community comes with me if I'm traveling to access care. And again, recognizing that that separation from the community has significant health outcomes as well. And I think, too, again, thinking about those sort of responsibilities and relationships within communities, that sometimes we assume that those communities can be relied on to provide care, to supplement care, to support members. And I'm wondering sort of what you think about that dynamic within rural communities.
Yes, absolutely. Sort of one of the, I think, most common stereotypes, if you will, about rural communities, where sometimes that stereotype holds true, and in other communities maybe not as much, is that communities take care of each other, or rural communities take care of their neighbors. And in many ways, yes, that might be true. But if we rely on that as a matter of policy and assume when somebody's being discharged back to their home community with a high level of need, that the informal caregiving networks will be able to provide that, do we know if that's true? Have we checked? Have we investigated or asked whether those home support services are there, whether their neighbors are able to check on them. One of the things that we know for many rural communities is that the age of the population in those communities is increasing. So we're increasingly relying on volunteers who are older themselves. And so that part of thinking through what's the fragility of that informal caregiving network, I think, becomes really important and is, I would argue, a very pressing issue. If the working assumption is communities will always take care of each other, then it also means from a policy perspective, we don't have to invest in providing those home services or those other forms of support in rural communities. Most of the home care supports, even if people would say, yes, they're not enough in an urban location, there still is more of a density of those services and access to those services in a way that many rural communities would say, well, we just don't even have the depth of any of those kinds of supports. And the volunteers do a lot to fill that in, but can't do it all. And then there's also been some interesting literature that talks about, well, what if you're somebody in a rural community who's ostracized or not part of that community, or you haven't been in the community, quote unquote, long enough to kind of count in a particular way? Are you going to receive the same form of caregiving? Maybe not, right? And that's not a good thing, but it is a recognition of how those relationships and those textures within and across a variety of rural communities may play out in terms of that informal network of caregiving, and raises questions about what's the formal support that's available.
Absolutely. I think we're seeing clearly the the deep complexity of of these questions. And again, the reason why they're deeply ethical questions in terms of so many factors that are influencing how people are treated, again, both within their communities and also within the healthcare system. So I'm wondering if you know of some strategies that have been effective in addressing some of these disparities, or that really speak to some of the ethical concerns that come up when we're looking at care through that rural lens.
Sure. Yeah. And the literature will have a variety of different examples, so I'm only going to select a few that are out there. But one that I think has been really interesting is the shift to thinking maybe we should be asking the specialist to travel, or travel to a regional hospital so you're closer, and then have patients that are from that broader circumference around travel to the regional hospital to see the specialist, rather than having to travel all the way into, quote unquote, all the way into the major urban city. So shifting up who's traveling, or having clusters of specialists do that travel, I think is a really interesting way to flip the traditional way we've usually asked patients and their families to travel, not the specialists. And I think that's an interesting way to see where that works well and where that may not work, which is partly dependent on what kinds of equipment and all of those other things that you were just mentioning that are needed as well, and sort of what is all entailed with a specialized service or visit as well. So that's one approach. I think the other interesting approach that goes on, and part of I want to raise this too, because sometimes it's tossed out as an automatic solution, is thinking about telehealth. So telehealth, I think, has a particular place to play in terms of access to healthcare in an urban setting as well, but primarily it's often suggested as a solution to access to care in rural communities. Yes, it will work well for some health conditions and for some people. But we need to take the broader look again with that solution and think through, does everybody in those different communities that we're thinking about, do they have reliable access to the internet or broadband? What is the policy around ensuring that they have access to that? One article that I was reading, they said, well, if you're talking to somebody on the phone and the cell cuts out 10 times, are you sure you've really done a good job as the clinician assessing what's going on with that patient? Because it's been so interrupted, is that going to work? And I think we all understand the frustration in a meeting using Teams or something like that when the connection goes out and it doesn't work well. So then thinking more about a high-stakes interaction with someone on telehealth, you really need to look at that much more closely. So telehealth, moving the specialists. I think some of the other interesting innovations that are coming out of rural communities, too, is the interdisciplinary mix of different health professions. So really thinking more broadly around, if we have a collaborative care center, who needs to be part of that center? So who's part of that primary care approach? And really thinking of it almost more as a one-stop shop. So if you're here to see the physician, to see the nurse practitioner, you might also be able to see the occupational therapist, the physiotherapist, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe we have a social worker. Maybe we have something else. Maybe we have the direct connect to the formal support services that are available in the various communities around. So I think that flexibility in approach about thinking about a collaborative care center has also been really useful.
So again, sort of rethinking what the default way
yes.
of getting care is, but again, also highlighting the full range of things mm-hmm. that matter in terms of good care.
Yes.
If we're looking to provide that. So I'm wondering in with those strategies and with others in the literature, if there's ways in which addressing some of the concerns related to care in rural settings, if that also affects or benefits those who are living in urban or suburban settings.
I think it absolutely can. Part of it is if we start from the rural perspective and really rely more heavily on the things that make care strong or useful from their perspective, it is often about relationship, about feeling that your needs are heard and listened to, which is something any patient wants. But it happens in a particular way often in rural communities. And I think the more we can use those insights to say, how do we bring that into our larger facilities? How does that help us make those facilities more friendly for folks? Can really shift the dynamic. One strategy that was being used outside of Edmonton, I believe, was also using some of their surgical sites just outside of Edmonton that were maybe underused for a while, and inviting people from Edmonton to travel out to those locations for day surgeries and those different aspects. And one of the things that was highlighted in that is that people often said, I really like coming to the smaller facility. I can find my way around much more easily. People remember me if I'm coming back a second time, so they know who I am. And I think those are sort of some of the insights that if we pay attention to those aspects from a rural perspective and bring that into an urban setting, we may still need to have a very large healthcare facility. But what does it mean to build a relationship? What does it mean to build a connection? How do we help people find their way around facilities in ways that acknowledge what it means to be sick and to be feeling vulnerable and needing somebody to care for you in those particular ways?
Yeah, I think there's sort of on the flip side of some of that too, sometimes in the discussion around things like MAID, where some of the concern is that people are requesting it because of a lack of services and that it reflects a particular vulnerability there. Sort of, how do we help to bring sort of the reality of some of those challenges into the discussion around sort of those big policy questions like MAID in the national context?
Yeah. So I think MAID is definitely a great example to see the tension that has been identified even previous to sort of the upcoming legislative changes, which is who has access to MAID. So where are the MAID providers and MAID assessors located? Predominantly in urban locations. And so even that part of, can we do assessments virtually? Is that appropriate? Does that make sense? Do we want to rely on virtual alone? So those questions of access start to come into it in that particular way too. But also if we're emphasizing not only with MAID, but with other health services, if you want that at home, we'll be able to provide it at home. Can we? Are MAID providers prepared to travel to people's homes in rural locations or very distant rural locations? So that raises, as you said, sort of that broader policy issue about where are we headed with policies. And as we've been talking, we've kind of implicitly or touched on what about travel policies? What do we reimburse for travel? Do you get a travel companion or not? All of those different aspects, along with policies around broadband, around sort of how we think about implementing MAID or the upcoming changes to MAID in a way that really makes it accessible to any and all, being mindful of, well, our policies about home support services or what services are available in different communities might make a difference to whether people feel that they are suffering or not. That broader piece of policy becomes really quite relevant in terms of both the intersections of all of those policies, but also, again, going back to the default. So if the default is typically looking at policy and developing policy from an urban perspective, we're going to miss the ways in which people are falling through the cracks in urban locations, but also predominantly, I would argue, in rural. And so there is a concept called rural proofing of policy that is really, I think, gaining hold, and people are looking at it much more closely. And rural proofing is applying a framework and ensuring that rural issues are addressed in policy. And I'm of, I think, two minds right now about rural proofing, because part of me says, wonderful, I really like the intentionality behind that approach to think not only what the outcome of the policy is and have we looked at it from a rural lens, but progressively over time, really starting to build rural in from the beginning of policy development. So if it has that ability to influence policy development from the beginning, I think that's the real richness of a rural proofing approach. But the other part of me says, it tells us something about the othering that is happening or the default assumptions, going back to where we started in our conversation today, is that it says the urban is the norm. That's where we're going to start with. If we have to build in rural proofing, it still tells us that we have a long way to go in terms of destabilizing the norm of urban perspectives only, or that they gain priority. And I think it sets up, potentially sets up, more of a competition between rural and urban communities than what we're really looking for in a Canadian publicly funded healthcare system.
I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle here. And again, that those structural pieces and the way that we embed them in policy and in practice, I think, have really been a nice thread through this conversation. And I think, too, also the balancing of values. So, you know, thinking maybe most fundamentally about sort of the value of efficiency, which is, you know, very dominant in a lot of public policy and resource allocation discussions, alongside the value of recognition and solidarity with those who, you know, live in communities other than what are thought to be or presented sometimes unquestioningly as the norm or as sort of similar to those making the policy sort of thing. So I think it's been an incredibly rich discussion. And so as we come to a conclusion for, you know, for this part of the conversation, although hopefully, you know, it will continue to resonate for listeners, I'm wondering if you can give us sort of a quick summary of, you know, for you, you know, with all the work that you've done around, you know, why it's complicated when we start trying to address these sorts of ethical concerns that we have about access to care in rural communities.
Yes. Yes, it's definitely complicated. I think in preparing for our conversation today, that's the theme that kept resonating for me. It's complicated because I think there's so many different layers that come into this. So part of what I would encourage listeners to do is question the assumptions you're making, whether it's an assumption about a rural perspective or community or an assumption about an urban. And the more we can pick up on what those assumptions are and check, do we have this right? Are we using the right information? Are we framing this appropriately? I think that that helps to address some of the complexity, but it will also reveal deeper complexity too, which links to what you were just saying, Marika, around the balancing and weighing of some of those different values that are going to be in tension as we make decisions about where public funds are allocated, whether it's for healthcare or other public policy too. Questions of solidarity, of efficiency, of equity, of what do we owe each other fundamentally from a healthcare perspective, but also what are the things that we need to live our lives well no matter where we live? Those are complicated questions. There's no easy or straightforward answer. But what I'd really love to see coming out of this conversation about access to care in rural settings is more of a conversation about what does access to care mean in rural settings.
Terrific. And we'll leave that as an exercise for the exercise for the reader, as sometimes is used in literature. Thank you so much, Christy, for sharing, you know, your insights that come from your lived experience, your expertise, and, you know, the time that you've spent working through these questions. We so appreciate the time that you've taken to spend with us today. And again, all that you've shared in the conversation. And we're also grateful, of course, for the production support that we receive from Lisbeth Vithoff-Nielsen, Krista Mlischko-Skerry, and the team at Dalhousie MedIT, who might be our most faithful listeners. Thanks to Ben Capps for our theme music, and most of all, thank you for listening. Until next time.